Okay, and now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, John L. from San Diego.
My name's John, I'm an alcoholic. And I am grateful to be alive and grateful to be sober tonight. I'd like to thank the group and Larry for having me. You know, it really is an honor for me and a privilege to give back. I've been a nervous wreck all day. I'll tell you the truth. I went fishing with my daughter this morning. She's 12, and she outfished me again. And, you know, I think if she would caught another one, I would have had the right on it. But I will tell you what it was like and what happened and what it's like today. I was born and raised in Philadelphia, and that's where I lived up until last July. And my wife and my kids and myself, we were moved out here because of my job. And, you know, that was a tough deal. You know, the first 19 years sober, that's where I was. And, you know, hundreds of people that I knew in sobriety, you know, I left behind. And, you know, my family and her family. And, you know, it was a rough deal coming over here. But I think it was probably the second day that we were in San Diego. She was in a meeting, and the next day I was in a meeting. And, you know, we started finding one person after another that introduced us to more and more people. And, you know, we're really plugged in. You know, I do have a sponsor, and he's here tonight, Mike G. And I have a home group today, the Great Fact Group. Best home group in the world, I believe. So, people have really, really opened their arms and opened their hearts to us. And I'll tell you, I could just go on and on about it, but I'll be ever grateful. I always say God put the right people in my path at the right time, and I still believe that He does that. You know, like I said, I was born and raised in Philadelphia, and my mother, my father, my sister, I had an identical twin brother and my grandmother. We all lived in the same house, and, you know, they didn't drink. I did, you know, and they were a great family. I always say that. I came from a very, very good, loving family. And probably the first drink was 12, 13 years old, I would guess. And I've been off to the races ever since, till the higher power saw fit to get me sober. You know, I always said my father could take it or leave it. He was a meat cutter, and if he said, "I'm walking around to the bar for a beer and a sandwich," that's what he meant, and he came home. My mother's never touched it to this day. My grandmother never did until the day she died. And my younger sister, she got drunk one time on senior week down the shore. She blacked out, she threw up, and she never drank again, and to this day I can't understand that. You know what I mean? I mean, for me, because, you know, it was par for the course for me. I mean, you know, her, it happened to one time, and it was the worst thing that ever happened to her. You know, and I just felt like telling her, perseverance. You know what I mean? You can do it. You know what I mean? And that was all it took for her, is one shot, and that was enough for her, and she never did it again. You know what I mean? But me, on the other hand, you know, once I started, I couldn't stop. You know, after the first one, all bets were off. I couldn't tell you where I would end up, what I would do, what would happen to me. You know, and I still feel that way standing here tonight. There's absolutely no reservation in my mind that I'm an alcoholic, and if I take one drink, I'm off to the races, and I couldn't tell you what would happen to me, where I would end up, or what I would do. You know, and that is all I am. I'm just an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic ender. I'm not cross-addicted. I'm an alcoholic. I mean, that's it. You know, alcohol brought me to my knees. You know, I hear people say when I partied, I don't know what that means. I mean, I was the animal that you found on your front steps in the morning, you know, still drinking. You know, so, you know, for me, you know, when I went to high school, everybody went to the same high school in the city. And to this day, I still don't know if my mother and father saw something in me they didn't like, or, you know, who I was running around with, me and my brother. And we ended up going to a school in North Philadelphia where it took a trolley and a bus each way every single day for 4 years. And I always called it the suit and tie school. And, you know, for me, by that age, at 14, I was a morning drinker. You know, by 15, I was a daily drinker. I mean, all that meant to me, I would get the old heads on the corner the night before, either hit the state store or the deli, and then I would take that and run down the railroad tracks and hide it till the next morning. And I would drink as much as I could walking down to get to the trolley, as much as I could before the bus came. And if I could get a couple more whacks before I went into the doors of school, I would do it. So that was 14, 15 years old, and, you know, daily drinker, I mean, I drank every day that I could get it. You know, and I know it had me from day one, drink one, between the years. No doubt in my mind. You know, I went into the school doors 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. My mind was already at 3 o'clock. I couldn't wait to get out, get home, get changed, get back up to the park, get back up to the corner. And that's just from day one, drink one. I mean, I hear people say when I crossed the line, I honestly don't know that there was a line for me to cross. The longer I drank, the worse I got. The worse my mind got, the worse my thinking got. You know, I do know that much. You know, the only thing I can tell you about high school, I hated every single person there. 4 years. Honestly, and I mean, I really mean that. I couldn't stand them. I mean, they weren't the people from my corner, from my neighborhood, you know, all that nonsense. You know, and really what I learned in AA, I mean, hindsight being 2020, a lot of resentments that I had against these people because they dressed better than me and blah, blah, blah. They probably weren't out on benders. You know, at 14, 15, 16 years old, you know, and I stunk and they didn't, you know, from drinking. You know, and they came there to school and they did their deal and I couldn't stand being there. I'll be honest with you. You know, so, you know, it was just 4 years and I graduated and that was the end of that story, you know what I mean, for high school. But, you know, I was drinking every day by the time I got done high school. You know, and like I said, my parents, they knew nothing about sobriety. They knew nothing about alcoholism. They knew nothing about it. You know, and that was a free drink ticket to me, I'll tell you. And I didn't understand it back then either. I just figured that everybody drank like I did. And I put myself around those people that I thought drank like me. You know, and that was one of the big, I guess, illusions for me that I found out later on. You know, that I thought everybody drank like I did. You know, my father was a good guy, man. He was a tough guy, but he was a good guy. He was fair. And at 16, he made sure that me and my brother both had a license, that we had a car, insurance, the whole bit. You know what I mean? And the way I repaid him, I hit everything possible that he could hit. That's how I repaid his kindness, you know what I mean? Made the newsreels a couple times in Philadelphia, and, you know, my family had to watch that. You know, if I went from one bar to another bar, it was 10 houses away, I drove. You know, I became a quad state offender with the DUIs and then finally a DWI later on, you know what I mean? And that's how I repaid, you know, anybody that was kind to me, including my own family. You know, so I ended up with a job right out of high school at the Philly International Airport. And it was a union shop, and I was making more money than anybody in the neighborhood. You know, and it was just never enough, you know, because of the drinking. And the stealing took off down there. A lot of people went on vacation without jewelry, clothes, electronics, you name it. You know, and that's how the bartender was getting paid. And I was making good money. You know, and I had that job for almost 2 years. My brother had been working at a place in New Jersey, and he knew what was going on down there. He said, you know, you ought to get out of there, you know, before it's too late. And, you know, by that point, 18 years old, like I said, man, there wasn't much connecting upstairs anymore either, you know, even by 18, because of the drinking. And I towed a plane one night from one side of the airport across all the live runways to the other side, wearing a headset, listening to the tower while it was snowing, and they were supposed to tell me when to stop and when to go, because I was going across live runways. And to this day, the only thing I remember about that was asking the guy when I got to the other side if he wanted a ride, and the poor guy looked like he saw a ghost. You know, so, I mean, I had no regard for anybody, you know, or myself. You know, and the FBI got involved down there, and that's when I left, you know, and went to work with my brother. He said, you know, you ought to come over here. This guy will hire you on the spot. He's a drunk. You know, you know what I mean? For me at that age, I'm thinking, okay. And, you know, I walked out of that job, and, you know, that job, the only thing I didn't like about it when I first started, it was 9 to 5. And I was working with guys my dad's age. You know, when they said at lunch they were going to go up to Rosie's for a sandwich and a beer, that's what they meant. You know, and something in me even then knew that it wasn't probably a good idea if I went with them. Because once I started, I couldn't stop. And it was a good shot that if I did, I wouldn't go back to work, or if I did, I would get fired. But I was the first one punching out. You know, I was drinking as much as I could before I got down there in the morning. You know, and those guys, I mean, they couldn't understand it. They asked me every day, and I wouldn't go because, like I said, I know today that it was a good shot that something bad would have happened out of that deal. You know, and I ended up on night work down there, and, man, that was like vacation. All the bells and whistles went off. The guy I was working for, he drank, you know, and he didn't care. I came in loaded. You know, and I would leave there in the morning and go right back to the bar, go home and pass out for a while, get up, go back into work again. You know, and that's just what I did. I mean, I drank around the clock as much as I could. You know, and I left that job and walked into the job where my brother was working. And, you know, the guy said, can you start tomorrow? I said, how about Monday? And he said, fine. You know, so I walked out of one job and walked into another one. And I still thought the mentality was that if I got the job done, in 2 hours, the rest of the day was mine. If it took me 3 hours, the rest of the day was mine. You know, and the first 7 years there were a complete blackout. You know, the last 10, thank God, they were sober. But those people, they paid the price for my drinking as well. You know, I always thought it was their fault because they sent me to work at University of Pennsylvania downtown. And O'Hara's was right around the corner, literally. You know, and they had specials, 99-cent drafts from 11 to 3. And if I got on the job at 10 o'clock, my tools were thrown in a bucket by 10 of 11. You know, and some days I walked out there at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and other days the barmaid was saying at 3 in the morning, yo, you got to go. You know, because again, I mean, I had no control after the first drink. None. You know, and when we turned 21 years old, me and my brother, like I said, I was 1 minute older than him, identical twins. And my mom was still working. And, you know, my parents, they thought it would be nice to do something nice for us. And they sent us down to Disney down in Florida. And, I say to this day, if they only knew that's where I was between the years, you know what I mean, for a couple years before that, you know what I mean, no touch of reality. None. And they sent us down there, and within a week, the second day we were flagged out at Disney, because we were sitting at Bernstein's Bear Caves, drinking liquor, saying hello to people. So the second day there, that was it. Thrown out of the hotel, the airport, you know, and my poor mother was told, don't ever book another trip in that name again, you know, with the airline. So that's how they got repaid again, you know what I mean, for their kindness. You know, I'm not proud of that, but I just had no respect for anybody or myself, you know. And right after my brother and me turned 22 years old, we were working at the same company. And I always say, you know, I saw him 99.9% of the time. His truck went left and mine went right. And, you know, that was the only time I didn't see him during the day, you know, if we weren't on the same job. And, you know, my father got a call one night, and it was the Delaware Memorial Police, you know, a bridge in Delaware. And they said, you got to come down here. And automatically me, being self-centered as I am, I thought he got popped for drinking and driving. Because for me, I mean, that just ran rampant in my house. You know, with me anyway. I'd never stand here and say my brother was an alcoholic ever. But I drank like he did, and he drank like I did. You know, and they wouldn't tell him why. And me, he was cutting into my time. So I said to my dad, I said, why don't you let me ride down there? You know, I'll take the truck so he doesn't hear any nonsense from work. And we got down there, and it was a small room. And they showed me a note, and they said, is this your brother's handwriting? And it said, dear Mom and Dad, Kelly and John, I love you all. Sorry I'm a loser. He was drinking that day on the job and drinking at lunch with four other guys from the shop. And, you know, going up 95 in the afternoon, he made a right and stopped his truck mid-span and jumped off. And that was the end of that. You know what I mean? That was it. You know, so to this day, I still believe alcohol took my brother. Call it the disease, call it whatever the hell you want to. You know, alcohol took my brother from me. You know, and I believe that. You know, he was drunk that day, and, you know, that was his best thinking. You know, today I understand that torment and that torture that comes with this disease between the years. I understand wanting to be dead. I understand it. You know, 6 months later they found him. You know, and, you know, my mother and father, you know, in the neighborhood in Philly, they had 300, 350 crying people standing, you know, in the funeral home that night. And I'll tell you, I'm still, to this day, I remember it like it was yesterday. You know, standing there, you know, my dead brother and all these people in there. And my only conscious thought was, when's this going to be over? I knew what I had to do. I had to drink. I mean, bottom line, that was it. And that was my brother, my poor sister, my mother, and my father. You know what I mean? Just lost a brother and a son. And I'm standing there, and my only thought was, when the hell is this going to be over? Self-centered to the extreme, yeah, you know, for sure. You know, and I'll tell you, you know, even more powerful than alcohol taking my brother, it took my ability to get to know anybody. It still makes me literally sick to my stomach because I was with him almost 22 years under the same roof, and to this day I couldn't tell you anything that he liked or he didn't like. Can't tell you much about him. You know, that's what alcohol did to me. I mean, it took my ability to get to know anybody, my own brother. You know what I mean? And that, again, I mean, it disgusts me is what it does. You know, and that was even more powerful, like I said, than alcohol taking him was, you know, it took my ability to get to know anybody. And it took my ability to let anybody get to know me. I mean, even on the street, people would ask me, how you making out? And I'll keep it clean tonight, but I told them exactly what I thought of them. You know what I mean? None of your business. You know, like I said, I'm keeping it clean, but it used to infuriate me. People would ask me how I'm doing. You know, and really, honestly, you know, getting sober, that was a free drink ticket to me. You know, my brother killing himself. You would have thought I did it to myself. I was so self-centered. That was just a pity kick, you know, for me. It was a free drink ticket to me. That's what I thought of my own brother. That was it. I drank every drink. Every drink. You know what I mean? And I didn't think my life would get no worse than that, you know what I mean, over the last 5 years of my drinking, but it did. I honestly believe that the higher power let me see something about myself every single day when I came to that I hated and I couldn't do nothing about. The only thing I knew what to do was to drink. That was it. You know, bizarre things happened to me when I drank. Real bizarre things. You know, I thought it was bad luck. You know, I lived in Philadelphia and I came to in Maine in somebody else's car doing circles in a parking lot around a bank. And I'm thinking, you know, my vision's pretty foggy. And then it dawned on me I had a full-face Halloween mask on. And I'm wondering what people are looking at, and I'm thinking, boy, this probably wouldn't have been too good of an outcome. I don't know what was going to happen, but it wasn't going to be good. You know what I mean? And you know, my father would get the brunt of that, you know what I mean? He would get the phone calls, and he'd say, did they catch you drinking and driving again? Where are you? Maine. Where are you? Delaware. I mean, they didn't deserve that. You know what I mean? And when I say I was a blackout drinker, I mean I was a blackout drinker. There's still parts of my life that, honestly, I just don't remember. I really don't. You know, I said it finally came to a head, you know, in 91, I was finally locked up and convicted in Maryland. And I was still living in Philadelphia. So like I said, you can do the math. You know, a lot of bizarre things happened between Philadelphia and Maryland at that time, you know what I mean? And I thought they didn't appreciate my humor, you know, and it wasn't that. You know, I came to the next morning, and they handcuffed me and walked me down the center of the street on a Sunday morning, and people were all going to church. And it was the normal to me. I mean, I was handcuffed behind my back with a cop walking me up the street, and I said, hey, how you doing? Good morning. How you making out? To these people. You know, like it was completely normal. And really, I was embarrassed and I was sickened. You know, and that was the story of my life. I mean, the guilt and the remorse that came with drinking, I hope I never feel it again. And the loneliness the book talks about, it didn't come one-shot deal. It came in waves with me. It came in waves. I remember standing on the corner many mornings, no money, hurting, physically hurting, waiting for somebody to come up to the bar that I could put the touch on. You know, there was a lot of days that I waited to see if anybody owed me money, which was real rare. You know what I mean? But that loneliness, that's when I knew when I couldn't get a drink, if I was locked up, if I was in the hospital again, or I was broke, that's when I knew something was wrong. I knew that. There was something wrong with me. Still didn't know what it was. But, you know, the weird thing was, after the first drink, the world was right again. It was okay again. No matter how bad it got the night before or the couple days before, it was okay again. You know, and there was many mornings where I came to, and the only prayers I was saying, I was going, God, please let me leave something in the truck from the night before. You know, when I got in the truck in the morning, if I found a couple six-packs of Pounders, 16-ouncers, man, it was like Christmas all over. You know what I mean? And I knew that I was going to drink the first two, and I was going to throw them up. But then the next 10 were going down, it was going to be a good day. And that's how I got. That's how I came to in the morning. That's what I thought about my day. The first thought was, I hope that I left something in the truck from the night before. If I found hot whiskey, I didn't care what it was. You know, when I didn't, it was complete fear and terror for me. And I'd be driving down 65th Street in the morning, nothing to drink, and I would actually pull over to the payphones, call my boss in tears, and tell him how sick I was, because I was actually sick from not drinking. I mean, I threw up when I drank. I threw up when I didn't drink. I mean, it was killing me in my 20s physically. Mentally, I was just done. I was done. But it was killing me physically. I believe that today. That, you know, really had its way with me. So as far as crossing the line, I don't know. But I know that alcohol had its way with me. You know, that last 5 years of my drinking, I did things to people, I'll tell you what, I'd never think of doing today. You know, and things happened to me that I honestly don't believe would happen to me if I wasn't drinking. And I came to in places I had no business being in. And I would just get up and go to work. Like it was normal. You know, a good friend of mine, and I've known him 30 years, he used to come home, he used to work at the same shop as me and my brother. And it was in a Spanish neighborhood, all Spanish neighborhood in North Camden. And I was usually the only white guy on the street. I was probably the only one that spoke English at the time on the street. He would come home from work, he would find me on his front porch with his uncle. And one day, we're sitting up there drinking, me and his uncle. I got no work boots on, no socks, no nothing. And he said, John, he goes, you know my uncle doesn't speak English. I said, hey man, I said, that's cool. I don't speak Spanish. And I mean, his mother would come up there, and it was the same deal. I mean, it's just, I drank when I didn't want to drink. I never wanted to be home. Never wanted to be home. And I know today it was because if you didn't drink like I drank, I wanted nothing to do with you. And that meant my own family, who cared a great deal about me. You know, and like I said, finally, it all came to a head in 91. And, you know, I went in front of the same judge for a year, waiting for sentencing. And every time I went down there, I was drinking. And they pulled my license, so my poor father had to drive me down there every month. You know, and then, you know, up until sentencing. And the day finally came for sentencing where, you know, the lawyer said to me and my father standing out front, he said, the judge is going to cut you a break. He's going to give you 30 days in rehab to take care of your drinking problem. I'm thinking, I don't even know what a rehab is, first of all. I don't have a drinking problem. I mean, this is what I'm thinking. And then plus, you know, all the geniuses that I was hanging out with in the bar, they thought like me, they would tell me great stuff like, just don't go back. Or drive around Maryland. Stuff like that. So, you know, it wasn't the sharpest knife in the drawer. And that sounded pretty good, you know, a couple times when they said that. You know, but sentencing finally came. And I'll tell you what, you could tell me the most sane thing within 10 seconds. The insane thought, it always won out. It always won out with me. We walked up them steps, went in front of the judge. Judge said, I'll give you 30 days in rehab, take care of your drinking problem, or 90 days in jail. I said, I don't have a drinking problem. No thought process, no nothing. My poor father's sitting there like, what the hell just happened? You know, and he said, I don't think you understand. I said, oh, I understand. I don't have a drinking problem. He said, that's fine. They shackled me up. Off I went. They sent me to Aberdeen, Maryland. Talked to a shrink because they thought I was crazy. And I remember sitting with him for a couple hours looking at paint blotches, and I told him every single one was either a butterfly or an elephant. You know what? And I'll tell you what, I waited him out. And I walked out of there thinking, I won. He didn't want nothing more to do with me. You know what I mean? As the book says, I mean, rarely did I ever tell them people the truth. Rarely. I mean, never, really, to be honest with you. I never did. You know, but I felt I won. So they locked me up anyway. You know, and then they ended up signing me through the shrink that they made me see. She was in AA, and I just said this at a meeting Thursday night in my home group. She was a meeting maker. She wasn't in the field. She made meetings. She was a recovering alcoholic. She went to meetings. She understood the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she knew exactly what I was when I walked in those doors. She knew me from top to bottom. Didn't know my name. She knew what I was about. You know, I went and saw her, and the whole deal was, if you miss one, the state police are going to come up, they're going to pull you out, and you're going to go back to jail. So the day finally came where, you know, the insane thought won out again. And I was at work, and I'm thinking, she's not going to tell anybody. And I drank from morning till night. Because before that, I was planning it. I was saying, well, I got to see her at 7 o'clock. So, I got to start drinking at 5 in the morning instead of like 5:30. You know what I mean? And I got to stop at lunch. And, you know, all these, you know, thinking. You know, the scamming and the scheming. You know, so finally the day came where I just got plastered, and I went in to see her, and you know what? She didn't call anybody. You know, and I walked out of that night thinking, see, I know. She wouldn't call anybody. I thought I won again. You know, and it was a couple days later that I ended up back in front of her again, and my father was in there. And that woman knew exactly what I was about. She told my father, 26 years old, she said, if you don't lock your son away, he's going to die from drinking. And my father didn't know nothing about sobriety. AA, nothing. And he couldn't believe it. She said, he's going to be dead from drinking if you don't lock him away. And He listened that day. Because I'll tell you what, shortly after that, they put me in a nut ward. Locked doors, the whole deal. And I remember him walking down the hallway. He said, "You don't belong here, John." I said, "That'll be all right." And that was the safest I ever felt, being locked away. I swear to God. I mean, that the relief, the stress was off. You know, and I was in there, and I joke about it. But 26 years old, everybody that I grew up with, that I thought drank like me by this point, at the end of my drinking, they were telling me, "Don't come near my house. Don't come near my wife or kids or my house." And these are the people that I grew up with that I thought drank like me. You know, so the loneliness, it was killing me. And I went in that place, and I'll tell you what, you know, I make fun of it, but, I mean, I did arts and crafts in there, and I'll tell you what. I was good at it. You know what I mean? So, I made a nice cool belt. Nice belt. I made a nice copperhead of Kennedy, a plaque. My mom still got it. You know what I mean? And me and my wife, Colleen, and the kids were over there. Well, my dad was still alive, and we were over there at dinner, and she brought up the table. I almost threw up. She goes, "You know, John, I still got that plaque you made of Kennedy." I go, "Mom, keep. You know, it's fine." You know what I mean? And, you know, I heard Nikolai here a couple months ago, and that's why I laughed, because, you know, he had said about being locked away and doing arts and crafts, and he said, "Then I had a revelation. This wasn't normal." And I was howling laughing because the same thing happened to me. 26 years old, I'm sitting in there. Nut ward. You know what I mean? Asking me who the president was, I had no clue. Look, like in 92. I said it was Reagan. And they said, "Well, who was the president before?" I said, "Well, obviously I got that one wrong. How would I know?" You know what I mean? Like, I'm done. You know what I mean? "Do you like spiders?" You know, all this nonsense. And I heard him say it here that night. You know what I mean? It hit a moment of clarity. This wasn't normal. And the same thing happened to me. I'm sitting there one day and I'm thinking, God, all these people that I drank with, they got like wives and kids, they got families, they're actually working. Like, and I'm sitting in here doing arts and crafts. Like, this ain't normal. And then I was afraid they were going to keep me. You know what I mean? And the only thing I remember them saying the whole time I was in there, "Got to make meetings. Got to go to AA meetings." And you know, I got out of there, and for some reason I went to my first AA meeting, and it was the Upper Darby group in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, a couple miles outside of Philadelphia. And I didn't know anybody. Nobody. I mean, I got sober there, I did not know one person. You know, it was the scariest thing in the world, you know, for me. I thought I was too young. I thought they were too old. You know what I mean? And nicest people on the planet. Nicest people in the world. Man, they treated me with respect when I didn't have any. And they treated me with dignity. I didn't have any for myself. I always say to this day, you know, they say stick around, let us love you until you can love yourself. That used to make me sick and still kind of does, but I think they tolerated me. They tolerated me. These people tolerated me. They let me be me until I figured out if I even wanted to be sober. I mean, nobody ever forced anything down my throat. Never. To this day. Nobody ever told me, "You better do this, you better do that." Because of defiance, I'd have told them what they could have done. And I did that on a regular basis without them even saying anything nasty to me. You know, a woman asked me to speak or talk at a meeting. I was coming up with 90 days. One of the nicest ladies that I ever met in AA, and she said to me, "I know you're coming up on 90 days, John. Would you want to talk?" And I got this far from her face. And I told her, "You can go do whatever to yourself." And that's what kind of person I was when I came into AA. I was scared to death. I was in a rage all the time. And really, I was scared to death. I wanted to say, "Please help me," and I couldn't. I just couldn't. You know, people would invite me to go places and do things after a meeting, and I would just consistently tell them no. You know, I would go back to the old haunts. I would sit on the steps and watch everybody else drink. You know, and then I made a mistake one day. A guy, Dan F., was at a Sunday morning meeting, and you know, I said how grateful I was for being around these people, and I don't drink. And he's bouncing up and down in his chair, and he's about 30 years sober at the time. And he basically, I was sitting beside a friend of mine, you know, Big Ed, and he said, "I don't go around old haunts, people, places, or things for gratitude." He said, I do commitments. You know, I carry the AA message. You know, in prisons, in detoxes, in hospitals. He said, that's how I get grateful. And the guy leaned over to me. He said, hey, shithead, you know he's talking about you, right? So God put a lot of great people in my life early on in sobriety that they told me the truth. And they were very, very honest with me. You know, whether I wanted them to be or not, they were. You know, I had the same sponsor for 19 years until I moved over here. And that was a tough deal. You know, and he was the one that brought me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, over and over. And through the book. You know, I don't know when it happened. But when I came into AA, I honestly still didn't think I had a problem drinking. I really didn't. You know, I thought the first step was a two-parter. I honestly believed my life was unmanageable because I saw it every day in front of me. Every day, I believed that part of it. But I was still hearing stuff. My mind was a mess. You know, it was a train wreck in between my ears, in my head. And I believed that my life was unmanageable, but I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I really honestly didn't. And you know, sitting in there at a step meeting one day, I couldn't tell you when it happened, but it did happen. You know, the part of the first step where it talks about raising the bottoms. I'm thinking, holy cow, man. You know, just reading that, talking about raising the bottom, sparing me another 20 or 30 years of living hell. I bought into it that day that I was an alcoholic. And definitely my life was unmanageable. You know, I believed that because then I started thinking, the only reason I still had a place to live because my mother and father wouldn't throw me out because their other son's dead. The only reason I was still working, my brother worked there first. Another sympathy kick. You know what I mean? The only reason I was still driving, wrecking cars, was because it was works. You know what I mean? Like, all that stuff started playing in my head with the first step, and I'm thinking, man, and I felt it that day. I knew it. I knew it. You know what I mean? I just knew it. And started working through them steps with my sponsor, and, you know, we'd start going through the steps, and, you know, I'd go to a meeting with him. I drove him around for the first 16 years. And he was good and sober. He just didn't have a license because he didn't want one. You know, and I would drive him everywhere. And we were going to meetings, and I said, oh, Frank, what do you think? You know, the third step. He said, what do you think of it, John? And he had me start talking. You know what I mean? Start talking. You know, and one night, he actually got angry at me. I asked him about a step. I said, what do you think of this step? He goes, you know, John, he goes, right in the beginning of the book, it says 12 steps to personal recovery. He said, you can't have my experience. You got to get your own. You know what I mean? You got to get your own. He goes, you can't have my experience. He said, I can tell you what I got out of it. But he goes, you need to do it. You need to go through it. You know, he always put the ownership back on me. You know, 12 steps to personal recovery. And, you know, the big book, going through that sometimes day after day after day, it's written for an idiot like me to understand it. You know what I mean? But I have a sponsor who believes in the big book, knows the book, he has a sponsor, and so on. So these people, I can bring things to them because they know. You know, they've experienced it. You know, but that big book, I mean, it's written for an idiot like me. I'll tell you. I could identify all the way through it. And I still can to this day. Still can. I believe every word in it. You know, it's written in black and white. And I believe it. Same with the 12 and 12. Strong, strong language in those books. You know, it talks about resentments being fatal. I had an old-timer say to me one day, you know what that means? I said, yeah. And he goes, no, you don't. That means it'll kill you. You know, people explain things to me, you know, as I went through sobriety. You know, and a fourth step, that was a huge turning point for me. Because I was still nuts. I mean, untreated alcoholism, I didn't want to do the work. I just didn't want to do it. And I remember going to my home group, talking to every single person in my home group, you know, about the fourth step. And finally a woman, Maureen, came up to me. She said, you know, John, people are really sick and tired of listening to you. She said, you know what? Either do it or don't. And she goes, if you don't do it, you'll drink. So she goes, stop coming in here moaning about it. Do it or don't. She really hurt my feelings. You know what I mean? And you know what? I went to my sponsor and I did it. You know, and it came to that fifth step. And that was a scary deal. I mean, he was about 15 years sober. And I asked him, you know, if he would do a fifth step with me. And he said, let me go home and read it. I said, what? He said, John, people just don't come up to you and say, let me do a fifth step. And, you know, because I come in here with such terminal uniqueness. You know, I thought I was worse than Dillinger. You know what I mean? Lower than Snake Spit. You name it. Always looking for a loophole. Always looking for a loophole out of here. You know, and sitting there doing that with him, I'll tell you what, as you stated, you know, I sat there with my sponsor and started telling him things. And then he told me things. And it just went back and forth. And I'll tell you what, I walked away from there not feeling like I was walking hand in hand with the Spirit. I walked away thinking, why the hell did I just do that? Why would I tell him this stuff? You know, but I'll tell you what, the reward started coming. I mean, I started feeling better and better, you know, inside. I could actually lift my head up and look at people in the eyes, you know, which was a long, long time because I was full of just such shame and guilt and remorse. You know what I mean? When I came in here, and for a long time in here, to be honest with you, until I decided that, you know, I was either going to do this or drink. End of story. You know, and that's what it always came down to, the black and the white. There was never any gray area. I mean, I was either going to do it or I wasn't. And if I wasn't, I was going to drink. And to drink is to die. You know, and it scared me. It really scared me. When I got honest with my drinking and stayed honest with my drinking and the things that happened and the things that I've done to people and the way I treated them, I knew I didn't want to go back to that. I knew in AA that it was definitely better this way than the way I was doing it. I knew that much. But I wanted somebody else to do it for me. All the time. You know, I remember going to a guy, Big Ed, moaning about something. He goes, John, what do you want me to do? Take your problems so you can go home and go to sleep? I said, no. He goes, yes, you do. He said, you know what? You'll sleep when you're tired. And he goes, your problems are your problems. He said, deal with them. You know, bring them to God. And that's what these people kept saying to me. Bring it to God. You know what I mean? Bring it to God. Trust God. You know, in every single step that I went through in Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe for me, got me closer and closer to a conscious contact with my higher power. Every single step. Made me pray. It made me pray. Made me beg God is what it made me do. Because if I couldn't fix it, what was I supposed to do with it? If I'm not going to change it, I got to accept it. But I got to bring it to God. All the time. All the time. I mean, I can't do nothing by myself. Be honest with you. And I know that today. You know, in the sixth step, that was a real battle between me and my sponsor because, you know what I told him? I said, this isn't an action step. And me and him went back and forth one night about it. He said, yeah, it is. I said, well, no, it's not. I don't have to write nothing. I don't have to tell you nothing. You know what I mean? Because I wanted somebody to tell me what to do. And he said, you know, John, this is when you start living sober. You know what I mean? This is when you start living. You know, and I didn't believe him. You know, I went to another meeting. And it was an all-black meeting in Philadelphia. And I went in there, and I talked to an old guy in there, Mac. And he was a jazz player. And I remember grabbing him after a meeting one night, and I said to him, hey, Mac, I said, what do you think of that sixth step? And he said, why don't you read it, John? And they had it up on the wall. So I start reading. He said, read it out loud. He made me read it out loud. We're entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. So he made me read it again, and I'm thinking he's losing his mind. And he gets up on the table. He said, what's your name? I said, John. He goes, oh, I thought it was God, and he left. I said, okay. I got it. I went back to my sponsor, and, you know, we talked again. You know, and I, you know. You know, and the seventh step, you know, again, I heard it put in a meeting. You know, I was talking to a guy after the meeting, you know, an old timer one time, and he said, you know what humbly means, John? Humbly ask him. I said, yeah. And he goes, no, you don't. He said, it means say please. And from that day to this, you know, every time I pray, I just say, God, please. I take myself out of the equation. So that's what humbling means. You know, I went through these steps, and, you know, when I got to the amends, I had the list, and the family was the roughest one for me. You know, going to the family. And I was told things by my father that, you know, I didn't think he was going to say. I figured it was going to be a one-way street, I guess, you know what I mean? And he let me say my piece, and then he had his. You know, told me exactly what he thought of me when I was drinking and how I treated people and his own mother, my grandmother. When she would go upstairs, she would come down the steps and I'd be going up. She knew what I was doing and so did I. I was a thief. I was a creep. You know, and how I treated people in my own house, there was no holds barred on what I did to people on the street. You know, and I brought that everywhere that I went. You know, and these steps, 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll tell you what, they changed my life, but they also transformed my life. They consistently have me look at me all the time and to get out of me. You know, and I got married in sobriety. My wife, Colleen, and I'll tell you, we went through a rough route, you know, for about 4 years later on. You know, but I have an 18-year-old son, never seen me drink. My daughter's 12, never seen me drink. My wife's never seen me drink. You know, I just had this conversation with my son last week. I said, I ever pick a drink up? I said, you three better run. You know, better run for the hills. And he knows. You know, but I'll tell you what. It's awesome being married to somebody that's sober. It really is. You know, and a lot of wild things happen. I mean, 13 years sober, I thought about killing myself because some things were going on. Literally, conscious thought of killing myself in sobriety, hanging myself. And I was going to a lot of meetings. I was sponsoring people and I was praying. But I wasn't writing. I wasn't doing the work. You know what I mean? Resting on my laurels. A year later, it went to gas cans and rags. And I knew an address. So within a year, I went from killing myself to killing you. You know, within a year. You know, and I just had to get back to praying and begging God again. Begging God again. You know what I mean? Please keep me sober. And I do that every morning. You know, it's not a joke to me. You know, when the meeting starts, you know, it's still life or death to me. I come in here, and like I said, alcohol was killing me. It was killing me. Between my ears and physically, it was killing me. I watched a lot of people in this program over 20 years. In and out, in and out, in and out. And went on a lot of 12-step calls where it looked like somebody got murdered. You know, and one person drinking in an apartment. Terrible. You know, and some people just haven't made it back. To me, I was told it is a gift, and I believe that. You know, it's a God-given gift. You know, so you don't ever have to hurt from alcohol again unless you want to. You know what I mean? This is the only thing that's ever worked for me a day at a time, ever. You know, God is everything, or he's nothing. You know what I mean? End of story. You know, we have a sober family today, and that's all due to AA. You know, God and AA. I'll tell you, I don't think I could ever thank, you know, AA, what it's done for me. I'll tell you, my family loves Alcoholics Anonymous. My son's been brought up in AA, so has my daughter. My mother loves AA to this day. My father died when I was 15 years sober, and he told me he was proud of me. My wife was able to make amends to him 2 weeks before he died. Tell me that ain't God working. You know what I mean? He loved AA. Didn't want to know nothing about it, but he loved it. Loved it. Was at our house all the time. Loved everybody in it. Knew everybody that I got sober with. I've gone so many places and done so many things in sobriety. You know, I thought it was the end of my life. 26 years old, I'm thinking, how did my life go so wrong? I'm sitting here with all these losers. And I was so ignorant to the fact that every meeting I made, AA was saving my life. And I was too dumb to know it. And I would tell these nice people 30, 40 years sober, they say, John, keep coming back. I said, don't tell me what to do. And I was not nice about it. They would say, have a good day. I'd say, up yours. And I'd leave. A speaker would be up here like this. I'd be back there. I'd get up and start kicking chairs and tell them exactly what I thought of them, hoping people would throw me out of here, and they never did. Never said, get out of here. You know what I mean? Never. You know what I mean? A lot of good, good people were put in my life. You know what I mean? And they told me a lot of good things. You know, a lot of them died with long-term sobriety. You know, the Robinson brothers and, you know, Ed Stinger and Butch McCormick, Frank Moran, a lot of good people. Peggy McCormick, we used to call her Asshole Peggy because she called everybody asshole. Everybody. You know, and these were the people who were put in my life that told me the truth when I didn't want to hear it. You know, and this guy, Big Ed Stinger, he used to say to the newcomer, he'd be up there, and the newcomer would be badgering him about the first drink getting you drunk. And he said, hey, genius. He said, if I took a circular saw and shoved up your ass and turned it on, he said, would it be the first tooth that cut you or the last? I'm thinking that made sense. You know what I mean? Even to me. You know, and I just hope I always, always remain teachable in here. You know what I mean? And I just hope I remain teachable. You know, I always heard that you can be too smart for AA, but you can never be too dumb. And I hope I always remain teachable. You know, and like I said, I have a lot of great, great friends right in this room, that my kids love already. And we only been here since last July. Let me tell me that ain't God working in my life. I'm telling you, man. Awesome, awesome people. You know what I mean? And if I'm open-minded and willing, just willing to listen. You know, I do a lot of writing, and I started resting on my laurels back at home for a couple of years. Since I got here, I could show you my inventories. They started August 22nd, and they ain't stopped because I date them. Whether it's some piddly-ass resentment or some fear, I write it down. And then I gather them all up, and I bring them to my sponsor. Probably not as much as I should, but I do it. You know what I mean? That's what works for me. You don't have to look at it on paper. I can't lie to myself on paper. You know, I can write it all down, and it was said at our men's meeting that I go to on Tuesday nights. I can write it all down, and I think Joel's the one that said it. It's still all my messed up stuff just on paper. So I just continue to do the work, you know, to the best of my ability. You know what I mean? No matter what kind of day I think I had, you know, I thank God. You know, and there was a guy, Jamie H. I was probably four years sober, and he spoke at an anniversary. And I never forgot it. He said he thanks God every night for what he's given him and for everything that he's taken from him and for everything that he's left him with. You know what I mean? And that covers a lot of ground for me. You know what I mean? The drunk that I was, the animal that I was, you know, not to be that way today. You know what I mean? Not full of that fear today as much. You know, just crippling fear. You know what I mean? That I can do whatever I want today if I don't pick up a drink, you know, a day at a time. But there's work to do. I love this meeting. I do, man. I think it's a cool meeting. It's laid back. A lot of long-term sobriety here. A lot of people coming in. And the only thing I can say, man, you know, if you're new, man, you deserve it. Give yourself a break, man. You deserve to have, you know, what I have. Just a beautiful, beautiful life today. You know what I mean? You deserve it. So put the whip away, man. You know what I mean? That's all I got. Thank you. All right.